and welcome to our monthly special edition of Behind the Paranormal with Paul and Ben Eno here on Achieve Radio. I'm Paul, and this is Return to Rendlesham 3, the third in our historic radio roundtable series, marking the 30th anniversary year of the jarring UFO events that took place at Rendlesham Forest and the adjacent NATO bases in Suffolk, England, in December 1980. Ben?
Well, thanks, Dad. We're very happy, as you can tell by my manner, to have as our guest and host today the Emmy Award-winning paranormal journalist Linda Moulton Howe, reporter and editor of EarthFiles.com and investigative reporter for the Premier Radio Network.
And before we get started, Ben and I urge you to subscribe to EarthFiles.com. It's the best site on the net for breaking news on Earth mysteries, UFOs, or just unusual science and environmental news. And also to read Linda's books, which can only be described as brilliant. My favorite is the two-volume Glimpses of Other Realities. EarthFiles.com.
So, Linda Moulton Howe, welcome aboard, and take it away.
Well, thank you very much, and I think I'd like to reinforce that since I graduated from Stanford, my whole career in television and radio and books and writing and so forth has always been focused around science and the environment and medicine. So I consider myself a hard science and environment journalist, always have. And it was trying to understand Earth mysteries by going into labs and gathering forensic evidence that I found myself trying, like Alice in Wonderland, to understand what was happening in everything from animal mutilations to crop circles and all of the phenomena in the sky and in and out of the water. And I think, after a 30-year career myself, that I would put the events at RAF Bentwaters in December of 1980 and even January of 1981 in the category of the most substantive of all of the investigations that I've ever done, in which there are so many witnesses that would fall into the category of credible and authoritative, having been security and upper officers at a large RAF, which was England and United States joint base. And for the past 30 years, since December of 1980, no one ever said there was a top-secret investigation organized right after sunup on December 26th by RAF Bentwaters Base Commander Colonel Ted Conrad. That was the morning that Staff Sergeant James Peniston, Airman First Class John Burroughs, and Airman Ed Kvansak encountered lights and a craft in Rendlesham Forest. There were rumors right from the beginning that, quote, one of the men jumped up on a UFO or a craft or was taken up in a beam of light. The airman allegedly taken was John Burroughs, but even he did not know until recently that Commander Ted Conrad was already getting men he trusted out into the forest to examine tripod indentations in the forest floor and burn marks on the trees even before the famous December 28th night of Deputy Base Commander Lieutenant Colonel Charles Hault going out into the forest with his tape recorder with a team of men with light alls and with other equipment. That's the famous night that people have heard of the audio cassette recording of men saying this is weird and talking about radioactive ticks on a Geiger counter.
So much more to this than
for several hours, some two dozen Air Force personnel reported moving, jumping lights, thin beams of light coming down to the ground, and even a multicolored aerial craft on or above the farmer's field. One of the handpicked men in the top secret base commander's investigation was Staff Sergeant Monroe Nevels, a photographer and disaster preparedness technician at RAF Bentwaters. Monroe Nevels was born in Phoenix City, Alabama on October 15, 1948. Today, he is 61 years old. In December of 1980 at RAF Bentwaters in England, Staff Sergeant Nevels was 32 years old in his second military career after serving first in the U.S. Marine Corps during the Vietnam War. What no one knows and has not known until now is that Saturday afternoon around 4 p.m. on December 27th, 1980, Staff Sergeant Monroe Nevels had a surprise visit from Lieutenant Bruce England, the shift commander for B Flight Security Police. Both Sergeant Nevels and Lieutenant England had served in the Marines before reenlisting in the Air Force. Lieutenant England told Sergeant Nevels he was there on top secret orders of the RAF Bentwaters base commander, Colonel Ted Conrad. Here now is former U.S. Air Force Staff Sergeant Monroe Nevels.
I was in my home on Woodbridge Base, and I got a knock on the door. It was Lieutenant England from the security police. Came in, started walking through the home and looking throughout my home to see if there's anybody else there with me. And I told him that, yes, my daughter was in there. She was 3 years old. He said, well, does she understand what I'm talking about? Because what I'm about to say is top secret. He said, I'm here because I was sent by the base commander, Colonel Conrad, asked me to come to here and pick you up and let me go into detail what he said. So then he started going back and relating all the instances of the UFO on December 25th through that time frame. The story that I got from Lieutenant England was that the London Tower, on December 25th, when all this started, contacted the tower at Woodbridge Base and asked them to identify the object that was above them because it was on their radar and they could not determine what it was.
So London's looking at Woodbridge and seeing an object on radar,
right. Contacts
Woodbridge to say, what is it that we're seeing? And Woodbridge says, we don't see anything?
Exactly.
Had he said to you specifically in the house about the abduction at the site?
Lieutenant England told me that one of the airmen had been taken aboard the spacecraft.
And he was talking about what had happened earlier. Can you talk about that?
Yes, he just basically went through and told me about Sergeant Jim Pennington and John Burroughs were involved. I do remember the names were mentioned. And he said even to the point that someone had been abducted into the aircraft. And he said the reason Colonel Conrad has asked for me to come get you is because he felt that if he wanted an honest answer from anybody, then you would give it to him. So it's my orders. They are down at the Woodbridge Officers Club, and they are having a party down there. And when we get through on our investigation, he'll be waiting for us, and we have to go back and report to him what you saw. And so we left at about 4:30 that day, and we went over to Bentwaters and carried my daughter with me to the chaplain because my wife was over there in the chaplain's event for the ladies, and got back in the Jeep, and we had light scopes, the night vision goggles. We had those with us, and I had my camera. And when we got there, at the scene, we went around some forest, and he began to pinpoint things that had happened.
And, Monroe, it's very important to stress here that Lieutenant Bruce England, the shift commander for Bravo, already knew the site of the previous landing of a craft of unknown origin, and it was Lieutenant Bruce England who took you there.
Yes.
This goes then right to the heart of what exactly was happening on December 28th. Colonel Conrad had already had Lieutenant Bruce England go into the forest because Lieutenant England would not have known where to take you if he had not already been out there, right?
Well, right, unless he had been given instruction. All I know is that when we went out there to do the investigation, he stopped the Jeep, said, well, right here is where we need to stop.
Do you know where you stopped in relationship to the East
Coast? No. All I know is we stopped. It was dark, and I'd never been out that way before. I was astounded. Told him, I said, man, those trees are tall.
Right.
And he said, yes, and they said that the craft that came in, it did not break any limbs and came right through the trees and sat down.
Which seems impossible.
It's an impossible thing in our realm, but not impossible for whatever they were doing.
From perhaps outer space.
Right. And he took me to the site of the landing. And I proceeded to go into the area. And I looked around and see what I could find. I took my camera. And when we got in there, I saw the three indentations in the ground. And I looked at that. when we got back in the Jeep and slowly headed back toward East Gate on the way, I looked out and I saw the bright light in the forest.
And you were looking through the night vision goggles from your Jeep?
At that time, I wasn't. All I saw was the light.
With your naked eye?
Right. And it was probably by that time at least 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening. And we stayed out there for some time. And as I looked, I grabbed night vision goggles I had, and I looked through them, and when I did, what I saw was the bright green through there picking up from the heat from the object. But what I saw was something that looked like an eyeball, and it was very green around it, but the dark inside looked like a pupil of an eye. And it would just pulsate very slowly until I would get out of the Jeep. And I had Lieutenant England stop the Jeep, and I got out. And when I got out, the lights got brighter.
Like they were coming towards you?
No, it just looked like they knew I was there. And the light got brighter. And I said, well, I'm going to get back in the Jeep, see what happens. And by that time, I had static all over my head and my arms and everything. I knew something was wrong.
You mean the hair was standing up
right
on your head and arms?
Like you would say, static in the air.
Right, like electrostatic field in a thunderstorm.
Right. And I naturally got scared, too, because I didn't know what I was looking at.
Right.
So I get back in the Jeep, and when I get back in the Jeep, he's a little bit agitated, but then I could see the light would get dim. And then I'd move out, start to open the door, and it'd get bright again. But what it would do is sit there and pulsating.
And reacting to what you did in the Jeep.
Right.
What Lieutenant England must have been thinking about was that a couple of nights earlier, the story was that one of the men in the forest, John Burroughs and Jim Peniston, had been abducted into the craft of unknown origin, as they described it, to Lieutenant Fred Buran.
All I heard was the word abduction. He just said an airman at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, I said, okay, now we can go. And we went back to the Woodbridge Officers Club. And when we reported in, the maitre d' went to Colonel Conrad. Colonel Conrad came out and ushered both of us in. And inside that room, I saw Colonel Holt, and I saw Colonel Conrad. I believe Colonel Williams was there. I'm not sure, but I think he was. Security police chief was there, and he was in uniform. So when I got in, we discussed a little bit about what I saw. And then he asked me, Sergeant Evels, do you think it warrants further investigation? And I said, yes, sir, most definitely. That's when Colonel Hawk jumped in and began to assemble a team. And we went back from there to the base over at Bentwaters. And I picked up the radiac instrument. But I do know that when I used the ANPDR 27, that we did get readings after we went back out.
And that measures beta and gamma?
Yes. I did take the beta shield off and check it, and I didn't catch anything. It was all gamma.
So the beta with the shield off, you didn't get anything, but when you were measuring gamma rays, that's when it pegged on the 0.5 meter, and on the 5 meter, it was hovering around 7.
Right.
Some people say that there were 35 or 16 millimeter motion picture film cameras out there in the woods where the light alls were. I wondered if you saw that with your own eyes.
No. The reason being is that nobody from the photo lab was out there but me. I represented the base photo lab as much as I did disaster preparedness. I was the only one out there with the camera as far as I know. Now, there may have been some, but I never saw any. And another thing, Colonel Hawk questioned me, all those pictures you take, did you get anything out of it? Wasn't it film file? And I said, yes, sir. I processed that film myself. I said, I went home and processed it.
And you had the radiation that you know you got at least some gamma ray.
Radiation, so the radiation would have fogged the film. I looked out in the woods and saw the light. And somebody else saw the light about the same time. They were on their radios and they contacted Colonel Hawk. And we proceeded to try to find it. And at that time, the cattle were starting to get kind of edgy, you know, like they knew something was there. When we got to it, it disappeared. We couldn't figure out how it got out of those trees and where it went.
Because the trees were very tall and very close together, right?
Trees were close together, approximately 100 feet tall. So when we went out to the edge where there was a farmer's field, and Lieutenant Colonel Pollock and myself were mainly the leaders. We were in front, and we looked out and saw this object that was sitting over in the farmer's field about 200 yards away. To me, it looked kind of yellowish-orange, like very hot. And it looked like it was on fire burning. And every once in a while, I would see something shoot off that looked like molten metal. Colonel Halt and I both observed that, and we watched it. So we jumped the fence, and as we jumped the fence, it disappeared.
From your and Colonel Halt's perspective, standing there at the edge of the farmer's field looking out at this, you had the distinct impression that it rose up a ways and started coming toward you and Colonel Halt?
Yes. What we saw was so fast, and it disappeared. We were in awe about, you know, where did it go, what did it do? And I looked up and saw the lights, and I told Colonel Hall, sir, the lights are up above us. We all started looking up, saw the lights. There were three of them. And those three, one was predominant over the other two, brighter, and looked more like a leader. That one would hover and move around while the other two would kind of be still. And we began seeing the lights. Looked like they were probably about 1,000 feet off the ground. There was very rapid movement, no sound whatsoever. All the cattle in the field quieting down. It was just a still and eerie feeling because it was very quiet.
And, Monroe, did you see those thin beams of light come down?
Yes, I did. Those beams were, when it came down, they looked like a very faint laser beam. They were pencil thin. We could see it against the black sky. I told Colonel Hall, I believe that something is trying to tap into what we've got. I mean, you know, what is it that they're trying to find out? Because it's obvious if it shot down to the ground, it had to be doing something, taking photos, penetrating, or trying to generate some heat to the ground or whatever the situation was. The lights would disappear and be gone and blink. You could blink your eye and look up and they'd be gone. And Mentwaters would announce on their radios back to us, we see it, sir, we see it. It's over us. And then when it disappeared from their side, we immediately was able to say, here it is. In other words, it was like it was instantaneous from there to where we were.
The lights that you could see in Rendlesham Forest with Colonel Hall would suddenly disappear, and you would simultaneously hear radio reports from RAF Bentwaters that the lights were there, and then when they said they disappeared, you'd see the lights back over where you were in the forest?
Yes. We all had radios. We had three different frequencies. That night, we heard the security police get excited because Colonel Halt had his radio. They were getting excited, and they'd say, we can't find it, and it would be over us.
But it must have seemed very unearthly what you were experiencing.
Sure it was. And I could not explain why you can have something here. If I take a flashlight and I move it from point A to point B, you're going to see a distance in that. And what I saw was there was no distance. It was as though they were here, and I could blink my eye that quick, and they were gone, and there was no sound. It was so eerie that there was no sound. It was instantaneous. When we got into the site of the landing, went into the spots on the ground, and if I take a tripod from my camera and put it in the ground, it will not necessarily be even, and by the time I'm through setting it down, it's going to be deeper in one end than it is in the other. However, on these indentations that we saw, while being on uneven ground in three different locations for the three tripod legs, what we saw was that each one of those indentations were identical in size and shape, identical in the fact that radiation was being detected right there in those little pots where they'd sat down. Mm-hmm. The thing that was interesting for me was that all three were impacted at the same depth and same density. The implication was that the density of those legs, when they hit the ground, that in each area, you could say it was just like sitting down on concrete. In other words, it's all packed together the same way.
Oh, I see that each of the depressions in the tripod pattern, every one of them was compressed equally.
Right.
and that that was remarkable because the land was not flat, it
right.
was on an angle.
Right.
And so whatever this was that set down on that tripod pattern and made those depressions in the soil, it had to be doing something that equalized the weight on all three tripod legs.
That's why I said that it was gyroscopic in nature. If you take that vehicle, if it's spinning as it was and burning the trees, and it lets its legs down, the craft itself is not going to tilt anyway. But the legs go down to the ground, and one hits over here, and the other one hits another location, and the third one hits down, and they all have the same indentation. That tells me that that had to be gyroscopic in nature.
And that it was important somehow for the craft itself to remain level, which is why the legs and the pods would adjust.
Exactly. And let the legs come down and touch the ground as they would. And when it sat down, it automatically compensated all three legs. So then when I got really serious and started digging in, I found that there were burn marks on the tree limbs all the way around the vehicle. It was not just one limb, and it was not one tree, but all the trees in that circle. So I got the impression that it was like a gyroscopic object sitting there and spinning, like it was spinning like a top. And as it spun around, it was burning into the wood in a tree. And so I took radiation test and checked it on both the limbs and the spot where it was. I got radiation behind the tree, same spot, just looking on the other side of it, was nothing. So I knew that whatever had been there at that time had burned those trees. What I saw was real, and what I saw was serious. And Colonel Holt had a tape recorder, but he didn't know how much time he had left on his tape. This was back when we had tapes that are digital. So he would cut it on, and we would make something important on there that needed to be said. Then he would turn it off, and then we would continue talking and discussing. And then he'd say, just a moment, and he'd flick it back on. We'd make a comment and stop it.
Do you know what happened to that tape?
Yes, I think I do. The understanding that I had was I later talked with Colonel Conrad about it, and I understand that the tape was taken aboard a private aircraft and was taken to 3rd Air Force by General Gabriel and General Gordon Williams. And I was told that it was General Gabriel, 3rd Air Force in Germany.
From Ramstein.
From Ramstein. General Gabriel and...
There was General Baisley also.
Baisley, I think that's probably the name.
So you know for a fact that General Gabriel flew in his private jet from Ramstein, Germany, to RAF Bentwaters specifically to see what? To see...
Well, he had been notified, and as a result, because of the base being nuclear, he had to come down. I mean, he had to come in and see what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But see, there were only a few people that were allowed to meet with him. Colonel Hall wasn't. He wasn't one of them.
Who did meet with General Gabriel?
I don't know. I do not know. All I know is that the only story that I was told, that these two generals flew in, talked to wing and base commander, and they took the tape that Colonel Hall had made that night, and they went back to their respective bases, and that's the last I ever heard of it.
Was that the original tape?
I don't think it was the original. I think it was a copy of the original. I think that somebody got a hold of that tape and tried to discredit. In fact, I understand from John Burroughs about this woman that was on the Internet and claiming that in the background that I was being brutally tortured, and that is not true. That is not true.
After your conversation with the base commander, Colonel Ted Conrad, did you ever have any interrogation or debriefing with anybody else?
I don't recall having had one.
And did you ever experience what you would consider to be a verbal abuse in an interrogation?
No.
I wonder, at this stage, as we speak in July of 2010, 30-some years after, what is your own thought today about Colonel Hall's statement that the lights, the beams, and the craft were, quote, extraterrestrial in origin, close quote?
Well, I don't know the origin of what happened. I don't know where it was from. It wasn't anything that we had that could compete with that, and we don't have that today that I know of. Midnight in the dark, so dark you can't see, and yet be able to manipulate and get out without breaking tree limbs and crashing.
And jump back and forth between where you were and Bentwaters?
Cannot go that fast, and we have absolutely nothing that is that quiet. Where is the technology coming from?
Extraterrestrial technology.
Yes, it had to be from somewhere. Never at any time was I called in to higher-ups and asked to tell my story. No one ever asked me about that, which surprised me.
No one of higher authority, from Gabriel to Baisley to Gordon Williams, ever debriefed you, the technician for disaster preparedness who was out there with two Geiger counters in Rendlesham Forest on December 28th?
Right.
And, Paul, when I interviewed Monroe Nevels, he told me, to my surprise, that he had never told this story to anyone until I did this interview in July of 2010. And I have heard that same reaction from several people that I've interviewed, and in the third half hour, we will be talking about some of the other contextual eyewitness testimonies from people, even including one of the security people up in the weapons storage area above the Bentwaters WSA, which is now, we know, 30 years later, they did have nuclear weapons stored there. And he was watching on the night that Colonel Halt was in the forest. And that is extraordinary testimony that reinforces everything that Monroe Nevels has just said.
I wanted to give you
just a brief footnote. I did some research on the radiation and tried to find out what would an hour exposure to 7 millirankins of gamma ray radiation be equivalent to. Fortunately, that is equivalent only to one-third of a chest X-ray. What we don't know is precisely what other radiation might have been out there in association with craft that according to the sea shift commander, Lieutenant Fred Moran, at 3 a.m., because it's typed in his report, at 3 a.m. on December 26, 1980, that would have been 3 hours after the clock hit midnight coming out of Christmas Day, that these three men, that would have been Airman John Burroughs, would have been Staff Sergeant James Penniston and Airman Ed Kavansack, encountered lights and what is described as a craft of unknown origin in the forest, and the time, 3 a.m., and the date, December 26, 1980, are in that type report by Lieutenant Fred Moran, and it is dated January 2, 1981, a few days later. And I think that Monroe Nevels, talking about this for the first time in 30 years, sets an excellent context for going to John Burroughs, who is the man who for 30 years has been rumored about to have either jumped up on or been taken into a spacecraft in Rendlesham Forest, England. And I'm wondering, Paul, is he on the line?
We have John standing by, Linda, and whenever you're ready.
John, what was your reaction when you first had an in-depth discussion with Monroe Nevels?
Well, I mean, it's still hard to believe because to this day I'm not sure what happened. So to have him say that on top of everything else I've heard was just hard to deal with. I mean, again, I don't know for sure what happened, and to have people tell me that's what happened, it's just one more piece of the puzzle that, you know, it's falling into place.
But it would explain why you have had this agony for 30 years in terms of not being able to sleep well, and you and Jim both have been troubled by dreams. And I'm curious if you could share with the audience what you think are the most important details that you do remember vividly on December 26th.
Well, The problem we had, and Jim said it too, is that we didn't know what we were dealing with. I mean, from the beginning, the strangeness of the forest, the way things felt, when we got close to whatever it was, how it moved away so fast, it was just unexplainable. And I mean, I guess a craft of unknown origin is a good way to put it, but it was just unexplainable. And it was like, even Colonel Halt said it after his night, we kind of looked at each other like, there goes a career, because we can't really explain this. People are going to want to know what happened. And not only that, but there was definitely, they lost radio contact with us for a while. So here we were out in the middle of nowhere, not knowing what was going on and not being able to explain it. So, I mean, that's one of the most things that stand out, and what happened to us.
And the drawing that you made for Lieutenant Brand, your shift commander, the sketch, and that we have worked with John Rackham in England to try to flesh out into a computer illustration, which is at my news website, www.earthfiles.com. When people see that, they're always amazed, because everyone over all these years has thought in terms of either something that was triangular, as Jim Peniston drew, or perhaps a disc, as some other people described. Could you go into details about at least what you remember that is behind your illustration that is 30 years old, and even when Monroe Neville saw it, he felt some recognition?
Well, I mean, for me, Jim clearly was able to identify, and if you look at Jim's statement too, he clearly said it was mechanical in nature, and he was the closest one to it on the night, on our night. And he clearly, on the radio, if you look at Lieutenant Brand's statement, said it was mechanical in nature. And so, but with me, I've always just been able to explain it as the drawing I did, the lights. I mean, I can't say that what Jim saw, I didn't see that. I saw what I drew in the picture, which is more of a light type of object or whatever. I guess you call it an object, but it was more of lights, different colored lights doing different things, whereas Jim drew more of a, you know, it was more of a mechanical triangle type object.
And in my mind's eye right now, I am seeing that red-orange, sort of a deep sunset in dust color of a kind of egg-shaped thing sort of at the top, and then there is that white light below. But coming out are those very odd blue lights. And in the hypnosis sessions where you have tried to penetrate your blocked memory, it is always the blue lights that seem to have the most interaction with you. Could you talk about that?
Well, the blue lights, I mean, in the hypnosis, it clearly, yeah, there's something to it. There's maybe possibly that, and I want to make this clear, this is under hypnosis now. This is not what I remember, but it's clear that those could be some kind of intelligent form. But the interesting thing, way back when this first broke, back in the early 80s, one of the guys that was there on the third night was Sergeant Hall. Master Sergeant Ball made a couple of very interesting statements. First, he said that the blue lights appeared to be doing searches, and they appeared to be the intelligent form. And then he said also that there appeared to be some kind of possible intelligent life form inside the blue lights. So it's apparent from what he said and what I saw and what came out of the hypnosis that whatever the object that was there, the blue lights had some kind of connection to it as far as being maybe possibly the intelligent part of it.
And in fact, it was in 1988 when Brubaker did that hypnosis session privately, arranged it for you after he had done the UFOs government cover-up live. And your hypnosis was never seen publicly. And in this year, you and I have worked together in conferences, and I've used some excerpts. And in one of the sections, when the hypnotherapist says to you, John, concentrate on one of the lights, tell me what is there. Can you explain what your answer was?
Well, if I remember correctly, and I've seen it sometimes, but it's hard for me to watch, basically I say that's the life form, that's the intelligent form of it.
Right. That the light is the life, is the intelligence. And when you go to some of the statements that have been made by Colonel Halt and others, and we've got the transcript from the audio tape that was out in the forest, it is very clear that those men, including Monroe Nevels, they had the impression that the lights knew what they were doing, were monitoring them, and that the jumping back and forth was to them less a cat and mouse game and more a kind of monitoring. What is your impression?
Well, the difference between me and them is definitely the first night we got close to something and it appeared to disappear right away. And that's where the 45 minutes could come into. So I'm not sure what happened with us within those 45 minutes. And then the third night is what I've been told from people behind me, that I went into whatever it was and the object exploded with the blue lights coming out of it. So.
And when those, right now, when you think about it in your mind's eye, and you and Adrian Bastinza are trying to run toward the lights, Adrian is on your right, and you are seeing those blue lights. Do you remember any thoughts going into your head at that moment?
I don't remember myself remember it, but under hypnosis, there's different points where it comes out that they were communicating with us telepathically.
And do you remember any of the content now?
No, I don't. I don't remember it. Like, in other words, it's not something that I remember. But after hypnosis, it's obviously it was there. But I don't remember that part happening now. But now it's in my mind because of what came out under hypnosis. Yes. So.
So what is in your mind now?
My mind I'm just going to be straight honest about this. My mind is still having hard trouble dealing with this 30 years later. And it's like, well, Jim and I say we have trouble sleeping, we have the dreams. It's something that we dealt with that we do not know what it was. We do not know what their purpose was. It clearly came back three nights in a row. I clearly had contact with it two nights. In the hypnosis, it says it's going to come back at a certain point for us. So therefore, for me, being a person on this earth that's not wasn't brought up in that environment, didn't spend any time reading it, it's still hard for me to deal with to this day that I had contact with something that I don't know what it was. I don't know what its purpose was, what it did to us physically, and what it's going to happen to us between now and who knows when.
When you think right now of what you remember from your hypnosis sessions about telepathic communication with the blue lights, what comes to your mind?
I mean, are you asking me, is it that they were definitely intelligent? Is that what you're trying to get at? I don't understand what you want from me.
I was wondering if you remember content.
I don't remember. Other than the hypnosis, what they were doing, other than under hypnosis, they clearly were here observing us. They were clearly here for a reason. They were from the future coming back, and that they will be coming back at a certain point because there's a certain point in whatever we are involved with that's going to be critical to their future and survival.
And so, in a way, at least through hypnosis, what you have, we'll call it what you have come to remember subconsciously, reinforces the Jim Peniston 1994 hypnosis, in which he talks about that when he touched the black glassy triangle with his fingers on those symbols, that his mind had a download of what he thought was binary code and visual impressions, and he was left with a clear sense that they were time travelers from a distant future, and that they were coming back to gather genetic material from our planet to use as band-aids, was the word that was under his hypnosis, to use as band-aids at some point 40,000 or 50,000 years in the future. And for listeners who may not ever have heard this concept before, this has been one of the underpinnings of the R.E.F. Bantwaters mystery for a long time, starting with Staff Sergeant Jim Peniston's trying to remember what happened to him in a sodium pentothal hypnosis that was superimposed on him. I'm using a nice word. He would say forced in the first week of February, so a month and a few days after the December 26, 1980 event. Jim Peniston said that he was ordered to go to AFOSI and ended up with intel agents from perhaps both the UK and the US, and that they ordered him to do hypnosis under sodium pentothal, which is known colloquially as truth serum. And he said that he knows that he went into that office at around 1 o'clock, and he knows that he didn't leave till around 5. So it was very long. And at the end, they basically told Staff Sergeant Peniston that they were concerned about him, about John Burroughs, and Colonel Holt talking. And then they told him that it really didn't matter because no one would believe it because it was too unbelievable. And, John, when from that overview and knowing that Adrian Bastinza running to your right in the early morning hours of the 28th, your second time in the forest, your second encounter with the lights, and that Adrian went down to your right on the ground, he also had some kind of telepathic impression. Can you talk about those moments that you remember and have discussed with him?
Well, he basically said that as we were running towards whatever it was, he felt he was pushed down and held down, and then he observed me get closer to the object to come over. It came over the top of me. I disappeared into it, and then it exploded into blue lights going out. And as much as I don't want to go into too much detail what his story is that there was definitely some kind of contact there and some interaction going on.
And can you share with listeners what Adrian told you was in his mind when he went down to the ground?
Oh, I mean, I don't know if I want to really say what Adrian said. I'd rather have Adrian say it.
Well, we've talked about it, or it's been in public, that Adrian said that the light forced him to the ground.
Well, that's true. He clearly said that he was pushed down to the ground and held down to the ground, and he wasn't allowed to get back up. Yes, that part is true, yes.
Can I interject here?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, not to interrupt the flow of conversation, but before we leave the issue of the hypnosis, there was a question from a listener that's been sitting here for we are in our seventh hour of shows, specials on this subject, and we have not even been able to get to most of the questions listeners have sent in, and that shows the intensity of the discussion and how broad the subject really is, certainly. I just wanted to get into this. This is from Lee in New York City, and you covered much of what he asks about the hypnosis sessions in Linda's questioning, but he asks in his last sentence, what does he, meaning John, feel was the reason for information to be placed in his mind? Now, from that, I interpret from the alien or extratemporal visitors in this blue light or whatever was being communicated to you, why do you feel they were communicating with you personally?
Well, I mean, that's speculation, and that seems to be where some of us get in trouble when we say something and then somebody takes it, runs with it. But it was clear in hypnosis that they were making contact with us for a reason, and then they were going to come back later. And it never really went into why they were going to come back later, but they were clearly going to come back for us at a certain point because we were important to whatever they were doing. And that's the best I can explain it. If they were, we were tapped. It came out with Jim. It came out in the mind that some of us were selected for something that's going to happen here coming up.
Has that happened, to the best of your knowledge?
No, it hasn't happened yet. But if you look at the hypnosis and stuff, it's getting close. The timeline's getting close to when whatever they're going to come back for could be very well. They could be back. Yes.
Yeah, I've heard that from other witnesses. It does call into question, if you will, many of the interpretations of the quantum interpretations of the multiverse or so-called multiverse that Ben and I use in our paranormal work every day, and that question being, why would they, you know, how could we affect their future when there are all possible futures already existing in that concept? So that in itself is a major question, that regardless of anything else that's happening. Okay, sorry to have interrupted. Go ahead, Linda.
Well, Paul, I think it's really important for John also to describe the hard physical facts of what occurred after the sun was up on December 28th, where he was stationed, and what John Burroughs saw with his own eyes. John, can you explain what happened after the sun was up on the 28th going forward in time?
Are we talking about after Hall, or are we talking about the morning after Jim and I left? Because that would have been this one.
Okay, I'm talking about your personal firsthand experience, where you were stationed and what you saw.
Okay. Okay. We're talking about on the gate. Okay. After I came back to work on Monday through Wednesday was swing shift, and when we came back to work, there was activity out in the woods, and they clearly took something out of the woods and brought it onto the flight line. And I was told I was placed there because I'd already had interactions are wrong. I had already been involved in the incident, and whatever I saw, to call in on the phone, not put it on the radio, and don't call in anything unless it's overwhelmingly, something bad's going on. But there was a plane that came in on Sunday night. There was all kinds of stuff going on in the woods afterwards, and they took something out. So somebody came in and was doing work out there in the woods afterwards.
Now, can you fill in the details about the type of plane that came in and what some of the information suggests might have been taken out?
Okay, well, there was a C-5 that came into Beltwaters on Sunday night. I was told that there was also another plane came in over at Woodbridge. The one plane at Woodbridge was parked over by the 67th. The C-5 was over by the weapons storage area at Beltwaters. This part that came out has come out from another guy that did research and talked to somebody in the Air Force, and Colonel Hall said he confirmed, was they actually came in on the part that was over Beltwaters. They came in because one of the weapons had something happen, or one or two of the weapons had, they had problems with afterwards, and they had to remove the weapons and take them back to the States.
The implication was that whatever the beams, perhaps, or the lights were doing, that whether anyone saw it with their eyes, that there appeared maybe to have been interaction with a couple of nuclear weapons at the Bentwaters weapons storage area, and that those weapons might have been removed, and might have been removed along with soil, plant, and tree samples from the forest.
Yeah, I mean, it's just speculation on what they took out, whether they took out something they recovered, whether they took out something they recovered and possibly some samples and different things. But there definitely was a team out there working in the forest, and they definitely took something out. And the first part, in September, they're doing a huge conference in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club, where they're going to have, not just Colonel Halt's going to be there, but a lot of other different military officers are going to be there, and people that were involved with stuff that's affected nuclear weapons that were ET-based. And Colonel Halt's going to be there talking about Bentwaters and the problems they had with the weapons. And I'm not sure, the major also that may have confirmed it may be there. I'm not sure.
Well, you're referring to all of the incidents that happened at Great Falls, Montana, Malmstrom Air Force Base and Minot Air Force Base and several others. And Robert Salas, I know, will be in the September meeting. And Bob Salas is one of the Air Force people who was 80 feet underground when he got a phone call, a frantic phone call from a sabotage alert team member who said, there is this red glowing UFO and it is parked near the missile silo. What do we do? And that is the famous Malmstrom Air Force Base incident in which I believe it was something like 11 of our Minutemen missiles all went down in a very regularly timed sequence. They brought in Boeing. I talked with a Boeing engineer about all the investigation. He's now passed on. But he told me, Linda, there was no physical possibility in what we had built in those Minutemen missiles that would have allowed a sequential by seconds going down of 11 Minutemen missile sites. So whatever happened between that unidentified aerial craft, that is probably one of the most documented and discussed incidents in American history when it comes to what we'll call UFO interaction with missile sites. So with that as background and context, you can imagine that in 1980, because the Malmstrom Air Force Base interaction was in the 60s. 20 years later, that means that General Gabriel and the National Security Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency and all, that as soon as they heard that there were lights interacting and beings were interacting and that anything might have had interaction with the WSA at Bentwaters, there must have been red alarms going off everywhere, whether anybody at RAF Bentwaters from Colonel Holt down understood or knew the implications. Would you agree, John?
Well, not only that, but the DIA was definitely involved in this. And the funny thing is that I've never done this up until the last few months, but what I discovered is that whole area we were in was just full of intelligence agencies. The NSA was there, the DIA was there up the road, the Chicksands and the RAF Feltwell, I believe it was what it was called, which was right outside Lincoln Mead, Mildenhall. And they were located there, and after talking to Jim, it very well could be one of the people that was interrogating was with the DIA. So there was a definite high interest in the intelligence agencies in this, yes, whatever happened to us.
And the fact that there were nuclear weapons at top secret in 1980, what I was meaning is that with the background of what had happened on American soil to nuclear weapons, where they actually took out entire missiles and found that the targeting information, the zeros and ones in the tape, had been changed, and everyone was shocked. And I know that firsthand from my brother, who was working at Malmstrom. So they had 20 years of history by the time December 1980 occurred, in which they already had concerns about the unidentified flying object phenomena being able, at its own discretion and independence, to interact with nuclear missiles underground.
No, there's no doubt, and there was a high interest in what went on. I mean, when you have the Secretary of the Air Force fly in not too long afterwards, General Gabriel comes in, Baisley comes in, and all this stuff was taken out. That's no one can dispute that. The MOD said that happened. They were told that that happened, and they confirmed it. So you had a lot of interest going on. So, you know, there again, whatever went on was pretty, you know, extreme.
And when was the very first moment that you remember consciously that anyone said to you face to face, John, I heard that you jumped up on or were taken by a craft in Rendlesham?
That happened right after Larry Warren started pushing for freedom of information release. And whenever that document, the MOD, came out and stuff, people started talking, I guess. And that's when the phone didn't stop ringing between people from Nebraska, England, CNN showed up. That's when I first heard of it. So it would have been, I think, 83, 84 time frame is when I started hearing that.
And as we speak now at the end of August of 2010, what is happening in your own mind at night, and when you think about this, do you have any sense of anything impending?
Well, clearly, and it's not just me, it's Jim, Steve's coming on, had these dreams, Monroe, there's a whole list of people that have felt their dream activity's been picking up, that they feel something's close is coming. Now, I hate saying this because you see so many people with their sights up there that will come out and say something's going to happen tomorrow or the next day. And I don't want to come out and say that. But what I do feel is whatever we encountered, if it's really going to come back and what came out of our hypnosis is real, and what I'm feeling is it's going to be sometime in the near future. The near future could be a year or two, or it could be tomorrow. But it's not something I feel is going to happen tomorrow. But I definitely feel some kind of interaction is getting close to happening.
And what is your personal reaction to the concept that what you all interacted with might be time travelers trying to survive in a distant future?
That's half the problem I've got with this. And then that's why people will ask me why I'm going forward with this. I truly don't know what happened to me, but it makes some sense when you look at the tape and everything that was going on, and it could be possible, but it's not something that you deal with on a daily basis, you know, or have any way of knowing how to deal with it. So it's hard on me. It's hard on me to realize that maybe there's going to be something happen to us in the near future, and what is it and how it's going to, you know, affect us and what's going to happen to us.
And do you think... I just want one last question here. Do you think that there is any justification for the UK and the US governments to have such strict policies of denial about what happened at RAF Bentwaters and what has happened for the last 60 years with interactions with something other than human?
Last time I checked, we were supposed to be a free nation, a republic, and the people that were put there were not put there to dictate what we knew and what happened to us. And it seems like the people that somehow come into this position of being in power feel that they can decide what's good and not good for us. And quite honestly, no, I don't agree with it. And I think it's time that we find out what is out there and what could happen to us.
And what are you trying to do with your justice for the 81st?
Okay, could you say that again that you broke up?
We're gonna have to take a break, I'm afraid. Could you stay on the line, John, for a few more minutes? Because I want to come back hit that thing about the justice for the 81st security police at Rendlesham. It's very important. But folks, we'll be right back. I'm Behind the Paranormal with Paul and Ben Eno on our Rendlesham special number 3. Stay with us.